This is Thomas Poulter, February 7th, 1992. Psyche and Illness.
February 7th, 1992. Thomas Poulter, MD, lecturing on what psyche says about physical illness.
To give you a few, I think the archetypal article, if you will, on psyche and illness is still Russell Lockhart's Cancer and Myth and Dream. And that was in spring in 1977. And it appears as a chapter in his book, Words as Eggs. And it's an article, to me, that I probably read it 15 times. And I think it stands the test of time in terms of being an article that captures something that really no one else has said and somehow manages to put into words the intricate balance between psyche and physical illness. A second work would be Ernest Rossi's The Psychobiology of Mind-Body Healing. Rossi is a Jungian analyst. He started out as a pharmacist. He went down to Arizona and worked with Milton Erickson. And he's written a very comprehensive text on mind-body interaction. It's not a simple book. And a lot of information is in his references. And if you have a lot of interest in this, if you read the book and you read some of his references, you can learn a lot. Lastly, the Yoga Journal, November-December of this last year, 1991, has an article on the meaning of illness by Richard Levitin. And this article is fairly far to the left, and I think it's a very good article and quotes some people, including Arnold Mendel, who has influenced me, and I think is a real good introduction to a little different way of looking at illness. The article is called Cancer in Myth and Dream. It's by Russell Lockhart. It originally appeared in spring in 1977, and it is in a chapter in his book called Words as Eggs. And if you want one article, that's the one to go after. So I'd like to start with two slides. Rick, if I could have the first slide. And this is a statement by the great French neurologist Jean-Martin Charcot, who was a teacher of Freud. Disease does not change. It is we who change, learn more about disease, and perceive it differently. And we're going to be talking about a different way of looking at disease, and I'm going to kind of let it all hang out in terms of this and say that there is a way to look at disease that every disease, illness, sickness, and I'm not going to try to differentiate those right now, is healing trying to occur. And how can you look at illness this way? Well, I hope maybe I'll be able to get this point across. Charcot started out thinking that hysteria was a disease of the brain or disease of the ovaries and uterus, and at the end of his career, he felt it was a psychological illness. So he changed in terms of his approach to hysteria. And second slide, please. And this is a rather pessimistic statement from Herman Melville, who's better known, of course, for Moby Dick. When on all sides, assailed by prospects of disaster, the soul of man never confronts the totality of its wretchedness. The bitter drug is divided into separate draughts for him. Today he takes on part of his woe, tomorrow he takes on more, and so on, till the last drop is drunk. And you may wonder what that has to do anything, but what it has to do with this is how we as humans handle traumatic events. And indeed, we don't handle them all at once if they're very traumatic. We handle them a little bit at a time, and they can become very influential in how our lives go, both psychologically and physiologically, and in terms of illness. Okay, we can turn that off. About 10 years ago, I began, as a family physician, I began asking myself a fundamental question. Is illness the result of impersonal biological forces? In other words, germs, genes, and god-awful luck? Does illness represent unfinished psychological business that's being worked out in the body? And if you would go along with the latter statement, that our traumas, our conflicts, and our complexes are often manifested in physical illness, what is the elusive interaction between psyche and soma, mind and body, that allows this to occur? And can the relationship between various phenomena of psyche, such as dreams, images, alternate states of consciousness, and synchronistic events, be correlated with various aspects of body, such as rashes, sprained ankles, swollen livers, and assorted lumps and bumps? And can I talk about this subject to a group of Jungians, which I'm doing to tonight, and hope to interest them? And of course, the thing that catches me is, can I go out to Northwest Hospital sometime in the future and talk to a group of my peers about the subject and hope that the importance and the fervor that I feel in this message can get across to my fellow MDs? Well, I haven't quite gotten out to Northwest Grand Rounds yet, but I'm hoping to make it, and I'm not going to be waiting too long. So tonight I'm going to share with you a few answers, some theories, some cases, more questions than I care to tell you that I have, and the episodic state of awe that I find myself in at times when I'm privileged to witness the mystery of psyche and physical illness come together. So I'd like to start with a case, which is going to be more of a story. And all the people that I'm talking about tonight have given me their permission to talk about their cases. I've changed little bits and pieces, and they've been more than willing. They've been very willing when they hear me say that I would like to talk to some people or write up an article about your struggle with these things. The next slide, please. Now, this happens to be a disease, and anybody have any idea what's being portrayed here? I'll give you a hint that it's cold outside. Right. This is Raynaud's disease, and essentially it's a hypersensitivity of the blood vessels, of the fingers, and usually in the hands and feet, to cold. People that have this go outside, and their blood vessels constrict, their hands become white, blue, and then when they come in, they become red. So you remember this in medical school by calling it the red, white, and blue disease. And it can become very severe, and you can actually lose your fingers and toes. Up to 20% of young women in their late teens and early 20s have this, and I'm sure some people have it here. Well, Gina is a 35-year-old woman who came to me with this problem. And she had it diagnosed, and she'd had all the traditional treatments, and she'd been told that no one knew what caused it, and she'd taken different pills. And things were really getting rough for her, because lately, in the winter, she was actually getting little ulcers on the ends of her fingers and toes. Well, you don't have to have a very active imagination to start thinking about, when you see an ulcer on the end of your fingers, that more may follow. And she admitted that her attacks panicked her. There's some important things to remember about Gina's past history, and that is that her initial Raynaud's attack came shortly after she had a pelvic infection when she was in her early 20s. Also, she suffered from sexual dysfunction, which formerly was called frigidity, which is a word that's not used too much anymore, but I'm going to use it for the sake of this disease, and infertility. Well, when I talked to her, I said I had some ideas about this, and I really wanted to get a dream from her. I like to elicit a recurring childhood dream that often contains a secret or a part of the story of the answer to what psyche is trying to say in the body. Well, of course, she didn't have one. And then I asked her, well, what's the earliest memory that you have that you can remember? And she sort of, her eyes kind of went up, and she began to think, and she said in a much younger voice, I remember when I was a little girl, about 4, and my daddy would read me a story about a little duck freezing to death in the Arctic. Well, I thought that was real interesting. And I really couldn't get much information about it. I mean, that was it. She couldn't remember anything else. And I said, Gina, will you write home to Wisconsin and see if you can get that? Is there any way we can get a hold of that story? And believe it or not, she did. And so I'm going to share this story with you because I think it brings out certain points, and it also happens to be a great story. And it turns out to be an old Chippewa legend called the North Wind's Defeat. And it, as you will see, it's quite a bit different than a little duck freezing to death in the Arctic. You could give us the next slide, Rick.
What was the name of that?
The North Wind's Defeat. Singabis, the great loon bird, lived in a lodge alone. It was by a great lake over which thick ice had come. He had only 4 logs of wood for his fire for the whole winter, but each log would burn a whole moon, and as but 4 moons were cold, there was wood enough. The loon cared for no one. He liked the cold. When the wind blew the coldest, he would go out to where the reeds grew through the ice and, pulling them up, dive down into the holes for fish. The great North Wind felt ashamed that there lived anyone which did not fear him. Why, this is wonderful, he said. Here is one who cares for no more for here is one who cares no more for me than I do for him. I will try once more to see if he will give up to me. Then the wind from the north, 10 times colder than ever, came down. Great drifts of snow were heaped everywhere. Still the fire burned in the lodge of the great loon. Every day he went out as before and pulled up the rushes and reeds from the ice and dived down for fish that were always there. I will go to his lodge and visit him, said the great North Wind, as he saw Singabis the loon dragging home a fish. He went that night to a lodge by the water. The loon did not know he was coming. He didn't care. He cooked the great fish and ate his supper, then lay on his side before the burning log and sang a mocking song about the great North Wind. Now the loon may have known that the one he was singing about stood outside his door, for he sang the song many times. The North Wind could endure it no longer. He would see the creature that did not care for his hurting. He came in and sat down opposite the loon. This did not frighten the loon. He simply rose and stirred the coals of the fire about the log until they blazed and sent out a great heat. You are but my fellow creature, he kept singing, and he sat down again in his place. Very soon, icy tears began to flow down the cheeks of the great North Wind. He said nothing aloud, but whispered to himself, I can't endure this. I must leave. As he slipped out of the door, not saying a word, he flew as straight as he could to the places where the reeds and rushes grew. He froze the roots very tightly into ice. The loon shall have no more fish, he said. Yet the loon found fish all that winter. He was brave, and he laughed at his trials. At last, the great north wind gave up trying to conquer him. Some spirits helping him. I can neither freeze him nor starve him. I will let him alone. When the four logs were burned and the four cold moons had passed, the loon still laughed and sang in his lodge by the water. Well, now you can notice several things. Now that we've got the story straight, that Singabis, the loon, is no ordinary duck, but he's the great loon, which is a power creature for the Chippewas. And far from being weak and helpless, the loon stands up and defeats the great north wind. Now that's a lot different than the little girl, Gina, remembered. But it's not hard to fathom how a little girl in an emotionally cold atmosphere might have recalled a different bedtime story and might have been pretty cold, felt pretty cold about it. But if we take this information and we put it into a systems theory or relationships theory, well, let's see what happens. Medicine usually uses a reductive theory. In other words, you go from bigger to smaller. You take that Raynaud's disease and you'd look at the blood vessels and the nerves and you'd look at it under the microscope and you'd study cells and enzymes and ATPs and you'd try to find a pill that would reverse it. Well, that hasn't worked for Raynaud's disease. But if we put this into a relationship or a systems theory, it would go something like this. First, there's an imprinting memory that involves the imagined, but nevertheless, physiological experience of being cold and helpless. This is what the little girl remembered. There also happens to be a cold, aloof, and emotionally distant father. Despite the fact that he read a bedtime story, he didn't pick a very warm one. In her mid-20s, Gina begins to experience episodic hyper-responsiveness to cold following an infection of her female organs. She remains sexually unresponsive, frigid through several marriages, and she remains infertile. Now, we can't say that any of these events or conditions were caused by the others, but they're in relationship, and they affect each other in sort of a mind-body continuum that has a nucleus or leitmotif around cold. In working with Gina, we connected her body symptoms and her life experiences. She recognized that all these years, the little girl hadn't really heard what the story was about, and she retold this story to her little girl in an imaginary way. Well, actually, it was in a very real way because she read the story. She stressed to the little child the bravery, strength, and survival of the loon, that he was not a poor little duck freezing to death in the Arctic by any means. Gina learned how the loon is the oldest of all birds, has a strange human-like cry, and is a power creature that can dive, swim, walk on land, and fly, not unlike the shaman who travels in different layers of existence to heal his people. She became connected to her own personal myth in this story. And yes, her Raynaud's did get better. It's not perfect, but it's improved considerably. Now, an approach to illness in this manner could be called mind-body or psyche-soma, or my current leaning toward the term psyche-biology. In all these phases is the inherent realization that psyche-soma is a continuing spectrum without cleavage. In other words, you go from very fine, very spiritual, to very solid, very material, but there is no division between psyche and body. It's a spectrum, which Jung was very emphatic in pointing out. Important aspects of this psyche biology are going to be an understanding of the neuroevolution of the brain, especially the archaic old parts of the brain, how ordinary memory works, and how various types of trauma alter not only our memory, but the ongoing physiology of our bodies. Now, if I could have the next slide, please. Now, this is a side view of a brain, and we've got the reptile brain in black, snake brain, that the brain stem, and that houses centers for absolute survival. We're talking about respiration and pulse and blood pressure and heart rate. And if you're in a coma, this snake brain is still going. And if I'm in a coma and you pinch me, my hand will still come up. It's a very primitive reflex, but it's down in that snake brain. Above it is, the paleomammalian brain, but I can't really say that very often without making a mess of it. I'm going to call it the limbic system, or the emotional brain, or the animal brain, but let's stick with the limbic system. And this houses the emotional centers, sex drive centers, feeding centers, along with the hypothalamus, which is a gland that changes information that's given to it from the big cortex up above into hormones. Now, the word limbic means border, and I think of the god of borders when I think about the limbic system, Hermes, and I think of kind of the trickster element in the limbic system, because there is a sort of thinking that goes on in the limbic system, but it's magical thinking, where part equals whole, and to imitate is to do, and to be side by side with something is the same as to be in touch with it. And when you're in the limbic state of mind, or a limbic state, the laws of magic apply. The other thing to remember about the limbic system is, although if you look at it anatomically, it's a group of nuclei, if you look at it under some particular scans, it is loaded with receptor sites for neuropeptides. Neuropeptides are short hormone chains that are made by all the major organ systems. In other words, the heart makes a specific neuropeptide, and there's a receptor site for it up in the limbic system. So your heart really does talk to your brain and vice versa. And the idea that you've got you can get some wisdom from a pain in your gut or your chest is killing you is not so far-fetched after all. And we'll talk a little more about that later. Now, above the limbic system is the right and left cerebral hemispheres, which, of course, are the great evolutionary jump that allow us to think. And this is a hierarchical structure where a lot of the functions of the cerebral cortex are to suppress information from the lower two brains. Now, if you can't remember all of this, and I wouldn't if I hadn't gone through it a number of times, we can have the next slide. And you can remember it this way, that we've got Mr. Crocodile for the reptile brain, we've got Mr. Tiger for the limbic system, and we've got the boss here for the cerebral cortex, and he's up there for a reason. It's not his acting, but he's up there because he's the only person in the world that ever lost a check for $250,000 in Ballard. And I don't think there'll ever be anybody that does that again. But you can remember it this way too. So, next slide, please. Now, this is my conception of the experience of an event, and I'm not going to explain to you how memory works because nobody really knows it anyway, but this is going to be as good as anything. Now, I've still kept this hierarchical structure. The cerebral cortex, or the BAS, is up in blue, the limbic system's in red, and the snake brain is in green. The little yellow six-sided figure is the boss of all bosses, the hypothalamus. So let's say we have an event, and let's say that you get a horse for your fifth birthday. And I mean, this is really exciting. You see the horse, it comes in through your sense organs, it's processed for meaning by your brain, your cerebral cortex. Information is fed down into your limbic system. It's transduced into another kind of energy, hormonal energy, so your body gets excited, you might sweat a little, you feel all kinds of energy and excitement about seeing your pony, and also all your other systems are in communication via this peptide system. And I've got the immune, the gastrointestinal, endocrine, and vascular there. And so in the future, maybe when you're 49 or something like that, you think back about that birthday party, and you know, you can just feel the excitement you had that day. There's sort of a little tape in you, and you can just feel, you can feel how excited you were, and you can see the horse and smell the horse, and you remember how soft his fur was and things of that nature. And if you think about it long enough, or maybe every time you see a pony, you kind of have that memory. So it's kind of encoded. But now this is an exciting, pleasant experience. So that's going to be a difference. This is a good experience. And you can think about other experiences that make an impression on you, like your lustiest moments, or more less pleasant is being shamed as a child, is a very unpleasant experience that has a different kind of physiological memory. But something goes wrong with this magnificent system. And the next slide, please. Well, I don't know how this got in here. But there is something wrong with this picture. Any ideas on what's wrong with this picture? Besides the look on the Salvadorian general's face.
So people have no shame.
Perhaps. Well, there is something wrong. Okay, I'll tell you. Pardon me? He's holding this weapon backwards so that it's about ready to blow out the front of his elbow. And that explains the look on the general's face. next slide, please. Now, this is an example of what happens when we're traumatized. And trauma can occur in so many shapes and forms that it's a talk in itself, or it's a day's talk in itself. But you'll notice, we'll go off to the right side here. A traumatic event is witnessed by the senses, and you'll notice the eye is dilated here. But a very traumatic event short-circuits the brain. In other words, there's a built-in 911 alarm system, and associated with this is a little center in the snake brain called the locus coeruleus. And that's in yellow, in the middle of the green oval there. And when that alarm system goes off, it shoots out an amazing amount of epinephrine, which is pure stress hormone. The system then sends messages up to the limbic system, but you'll notice that the cerebral cortex is shorted out. In other words, the boss is knocked out of the play. I mean, they carry him off the field. Now, that's usually when we think of dissociation, we think of it as a psychological term, but really it's a neurophysiological term. In other words, when you get in the grips of a complex, and I think we kind of all know when we're feeling a little bit weird that something's going on here and I'm not quite clicking, this is a physiological event. Now, being a hierarchical structure, the limbic system does the best it can to take over when the boss is knocked out of the play. Hormones are still made, but and the neuropeptide sequences are still created, but what happens is that there's a freeze, fight, or flight reaction. And the individual eventually comes out of it, but there is pure or partial amnesia for the traumatic event experienced. And I call this a rogue software program, or to quote Ollie North, a loose cannon. Now, go back to the birthday party, and let's say that the same birthday party that you went to at age 4, you ran up to that horse and you put your hand in that horse's mouth, and you didn't know that that's a very bad thing to do, and you ended up with 42 stitches and 3 broken fingers and a trip to the hospital and 10 days at Children's Hospital. You may not even have a memory of that birthday party. However, you may it may have been explained to you by your mom, maybe, or maybe your parents just chose not to talk about it. You may feel awful funny when you get around horses. You may not like Western movies. You may be allergic to chocolate and chocolate cakes, because that was the cake that you ate before you got the bit by the horse. And there would be a whole gamut of things that any similarity to this event, this rogue program, could kind of slip in, and all of a sudden you got a gut ache, your hand starts hurting again, you get a headache, you get a panic attack. And this is a very important point in how I work with symptoms. Now, so trauma causes dissociation and amnesia, and it causes these rogue software programs, or loose cannons, and they can affect us in many levels, mental, physical, developmental, or behavioral. And next slide, please. Now, this is a drawing by a patient, an example of a physical or physiological symptom, and she has irritable bowel disease. And you can tell a lot by this picture. This girl was abused by her father as a preteen as a teen. And by pressing on her abdomen, which is something that I'm going to be talking about, in other words, making the symptom a little bit worse, she would go into a trance state, and she would have memories that brought up a lot of things for her about the abuse that she'd forgotten. Now, if you look at the picture, you're going to notice that there's no pupils in the eyes, there's no ears, the facial features are poorly defined, there's no fingers to touch with, there's no toes to dig your feet in the ground. In other words, there's a lot of sensory deprivation here. But where the energy is down in her gut. And so what we did, after I got a lot of information from her and worked with her, was that we focused in on making her irritable bowel like a sixth sense, and that she could learn to trust her gut, that her gut had a lot of wisdom in it, and when she started to cramp, she could take a break and think about what was really going on. And you remember that that gut is sending information up to her limbic system in the forms of neuropeptides. Next slide, please. Now, we talked about developmental problems. Anybody have any idea how old this little girl is?
6, 4.
Okay. Well, she's really 8. And this is an example of what I call a chicken coop kid. But it's a little girl who was literally chained to her room, and she was 8. She was finally discovered, taken to the hospital. Her growth hormone levels were practically 0. And put in a loving environment, she began to grow. And this is also called maternal deprivation syndrome or psychosocial dwarfism. Neither term you have to remember, but it points out that trauma affects children's growth, and it affects the way they think and learn. There's a form of pseudo-retardation where kids are felt to be retarded because the trauma affects the development of their nervous system. Next slide, please. So this is a new slide for me, and I was relieved to see these headlines in a newspaper called Family Practice News. But if I'm a crusader for anything, it's this one point, and that sexual abuse produces biological changes in children and adults. And this is what I feel is the number one health problem in this country. It's not AIDS. It's why 3 out of 5 women and 2 out of 5 men in their youth are sexually abused. Why does this happen? Why is this done to our children? And why isn't the sequelae of this known better? Why do we call people borderline personalities when they're really suffering from sexual abuse? And I see this many times a month with abdominal pain and pelvic pain and back pain and headaches and panic attacks and agoraphobia. If you look hard enough and you listen and you take the time, you find sexual abuse. So I am very emphatic about this part of things and about bringing this information into the medical world, where all these symptoms are treated with pills, psychiatry, or surgery, or ignored. Next slide, please. And this is the headline a couple years back about a serial killer in California. And man facing execution was born and raised in the Chamber of Horrors. Well, you look at serial killers and you look at the lives they've had. You can read Alice Miller, who's done a chapter on the childhood of Adolf Hitler. I don't make any excuses for these people, and some of them are more conscious than others, but I do know that there's terrible traumatic episodes in many of the lives of these people. All right, now, this rogue program stimulation doesn't necessarily have to occur when you don't exactly have to have a precipitating event. In other words, you don't have to see that pony. You don't have to eat that chocolate cake. You can just get fatigued. You can stay up for a couple days or miss your sleep, and you just start then dissociating, and this abdominal pain may come back. Your hand may start hurting, and even confusing messages that are given to a child can be enough to sort of precipitate this state. In other words, a good way to traumatize a child is to say, you know, I love you, this is going to hurt me more than it hurts you, whack. In other words, to whack a child with a nice look on your face, if you have to do it, you're much better looking sour, because the difference in messages is that it shorts out the connections between the right and left half of the brain, and the child dissociates, and he can get a rogue software program put in there, for lack of any better term. Let's have the next slide, please. Now, here I go taking a few pokes at my medical peers, but I guess I can do this. This is Dr. Freddy, and Dr. Freddy has I guess now it's a day surgery clinic on Elm Street where he does day surgery, so he doesn't have to use the hospital. It used to be a $20,000 sports car, and now he's got a $50,000 or $60,000 sports car, and the license plate just happens to be 007. And he's a nice enough fellow, but he doesn't know that illness, injuries, anesthesia, surgery, and the post-operative state are all altered states of consciousness. And if they're not handled extremely delicately, in other words, if the patient is not handled with care when they're injured, you can set up a very bad tape in there that can interfere with healing. In other words, if they're taking out my gallbladder and the guy on the end of the trowel, or I can't even remember the name of that thing anymore, that's holding my gut back, keeps complaining that this guy's never going to heal with all this fat, my limbic system and my reptile brain are listening, and they hear this, and they think in magical terms, and they think, gosh, this is true. And I often will see people, even adults, come in, and they have a laceration, and they're crying, and it's just a little cut, I'm just going to sew it up, and when I see that, I know that they're in an altered state, I know they've been traumatized, and I know that before I can even begin to work with them and try to help them, I've got to go back and, well, what happened to you when you're about 7 or 8? Oh, they held me down, and they tied me up. And right here, I said, and I'll work with them. I'll just do a little piece of work. I'll calm them down, and then I can hopefully do a plastic repair on what they have today. But I see this often. And a doctor that gives a patient a bad message when they're sick is literally like a bad shaman putting a hex on them. And it has a lot of spin-off, and it's not good. So now we're going to talk a little bit about mind-body therapy here, which is my answer to this problem. Let's see what the next slide says. Can anybody give me this movie? We know we've got Charlie Chaplin. It's City Lights. And Charlie is going out trying to get some money for the blind girl. And when he's out roaming the town, he meets the millionaire, the guy with the cigar, who happens to be drunk. Well, the millionaire is in an affable state of mind. He recognizes, he befriends Charlie, he takes him home, he wines and dines him, he gives him a place to sleep. The millionaire wakes up the next morning, he's sober, he's hungover, and he says, who the heck are you? And he kicks Charlie out like a bum. Well, the next night, the millionaire goes out, he gets drunk again, he sees Charlie, recognizes him as a long-lost friend, and befriends him again, takes him home, and of course the next morning, the sequence is repeated. Well, I'm going to give you a new word, and that's what the millionaire is experiencing is a state-dependent memory. It's state-dependent on the condition that he was in at the time that it occurred. In other words, they say if you lose your keys while you're drunk, the way to find them again is to get drunk again. I can't say I recommend that, but there is something to that if you want to follow this trend. But this software, this rogue software program, this loose cannon, have an overlap with this state-dependent memory. And that you really, it's very hard to get at it because you have to go back into the state that it was acquired in order to remember it. And so mind-body therapy is presented with a problem. How is the therapist or the physician going to know what the memory is because he or she doesn't know, and the patient doesn't know and wouldn't want to remember anyway because it was very unpleasant. So that's part of the problem at getting at these programs. But fortunately, there is a link between the conscious and the unconscious. Next slide, please. And that is the symptom, number one. And the symptom is both conscious. In other words, I've got a gut ache, doc. I don't have a state-dependent memory. I've got a gut ache, and that's conscious. But going inside, if it is due to trauma, there's part of it that's unconscious. But you could see then the symptom or illness is part of that old memory trying to break through into consciousness. In other words, remember I said that disease, illness, sickness could be considered to be healing trying to occur. Well, if you can look at it this way, this symptom is an old trauma and the psyche is trying like heck to heal. It's not like healing a cut finger, though, when your psyche is hurt. It's a lot more complicated, but that symptom is trying to break through. Framework works some of the time, more than others. And here's the theory that if you take the symptom, like abdominal pain, I'm going to use that, you saw the drawing, you instead of taking 3 Mylanta and a couple Tagamet and calling me in the morning, I press on your abdomen. It is conceivable that we may enter the limbic system by amplifying the pain, go into the state-dependent memory. Then, with the information, the person is having an experience, represent it to the cerebral cortex. In other words, what's going on now? That kind of thing. Retransduce it. In other words, send it, now that the cerebral cortex, now that the Baz is woken up, knows what happened, send it down through the limbic system and make a whole new set of hormones and neuropeptides. The neuropeptides come right off the DNA of the cells. And with the right electrophysiological moment, which I defined as healing, you create a new software program. And you'll have to excuse the computer lingo, but to me, that is a very big aspect of what healing is. And it doesn't happen very often, but it is possible to happen. So now you've got a kinder, gentler software program in there. And you don't have to have a tummy ache when you see a horse, and you can eat chocolate cake again, or a lot of other things. What are the problems with mind-body therapy? It's a great theoretical framework. Some of the time, it works for me very well. Most of the time, it'll work a little bit, and some of the time, it doesn't work at all. First of all, the patient has to be at a personal place where they can are willing to give up their symptom. And this framework has to be explained to a person. You have to say, well, this is kind of what I do. And it's possible that we're going to enter some very frightening memories. Well, if the person happens to be on L&I or in the middle of a big malpractice suit, they are not really going to be ready to give up their symptoms. So all the secondary gain that comes with being sick has to be ready to be given up. In other words, this is an all or none kind of thing. It also can be frightening, and the therapist has to know about working with profound altered states of consciousness, like rage, which is not very frequent, but like profound emotional states, sadness, grief, tears. And there's another thing that once a therapist or a physician finds out that you can precipitate altered states of consciousness, it can be very inflating to the therapist. In other words, you can start thinking that you can go around doing this to people, and it can be very dangerous. And it has to be handled with exquisite care, and you've got to have a background in it in order to do it. I work 90 minutes with people, and I make sure I have enough time to stay with people, and I make sure that I really know people before I attempt this kind of work. And I was going to show, had trouble coming up with a picture of an inflated therapist, but I did want to tell you about this fish I caught. Next slide, please. Now this is me when I was young, and I'd caught my first steelhead up in Spence's Bridge in British Columbia, and I thought that I was going to get 3 or 4 steelhead a year like nobody's business, and sad to say, I was inflated because I've never caught another one, but I did get this one. So there's a couple other things about problems. When you're working and retelling the story to the cerebral cortex, you have to tell it in a very simplistic way because the right brain has a language capability of about a 5-year-old. So all this business about talking to the inner child makes a lot of sense physiologically because you'd explain something like this in a way that a 5-year-old would understand. That was a bad alley, wasn't it? What was bad about it? It really hurt. Where, you know, in that kind of framework. So you can't use big words when you're talking to someone that's in their limbic system. The other thing is that you remember that the complex is pictured as an onion with skins and layers, and that the complex, these state-dependent memories, and I do equate them to a certain extent with the complex, have got layers and layers that sometimes you have to go through. A patient came in and saw me, and she had an inflamed thyroid gland, and we worked with her. And out of that came an experience of being choked when she was 18. And before that was an experience of being hung up in a rope when she was about 5. And when she was born, she was a breech baby whose head got hung up for a while. So you can see each one of these took time to go through. And it's a very intricate process that can be exhausting, but can be very rewarding. And that's, I think, what this inflamed thyroid was all about, because it got better after doing some work on it. You've got to be able to explain what's going on to clients. You cannot just walk into a room and say, "I'm Tom, and we're going into your limbic system." People that have physiological, organic problems from trauma often need a team approach. They need counselors, psychiatrists, therapists. They need groups like Adult Children of Alcoholics for the group support and the common humanity that these people need to heal. If little babies have been traumatized, they often respond to only the... There's no memory of being traumatized as a baby. And they just may have profound emotions, and they need the most fundamental of nurturing techniques, including holding, rocking, and bottle feeding. And that's what it takes sometimes for a little baby that's been hurt. I mean, you literally have to take them back through developmental stages. I'm going to go through a few slides here of some cases. If I could have the next slide, please. This is a lady who, when I saw her, she was 60. And she had had 3 back surgeries, went to see the same fellow. He was a Dr. Freddy type, and she was having some pain in her neck. And he took x-rays, he flipped them up on the view box, and he says, "Well," he says, "guess what?" He says, "You got it here too. Your neck's full of arthritis just like your back." Well, remember what I said about putting a hex on a patient? Well, that was a real Dr. Freddy kind of thing to say, because it hurt her a lot. That night she had a dream, and the voice in the dream said, "Are you lithic?" Well, she hunted me up. I forget how she got to me, but she said, "I'm hurting. My neck's full of arthritis. My back's full of arthritis." She told me the dream. I couldn't remember what lithic meant, but she looked it up. And it means stone-like. Well, I talked to her for... lithic means stone. So I talked to her for a while, and I got a feeling for her, and I didn't know what to do with her. So I said, "Well, how would you like to just kind of become stone-like and see what would happen?" Well, she did become stone-like. She actually went into tetany. Her arms, her legs drew up, her face contorted, her back arched. I was hanging on by the seat of my pants because I didn't know what was going on at this time. In the middle of things, she cried out something in a foreign language. Her jaws began to clench, and finally she did some spitting and made some retching sounds. Well, she came out of it after about 10 minutes, and she wouldn't let me get near her. And so I have a very small office, 8 by 10, but I was over in the 10 side, and she was over in the 8. And finally I says, what was going on? And she said, "I knew it." She said she was re-experiencing, when she was about 4, what she had always known something had happened, and this was forced oral sex with a mysterious boarder in who had lived with her family for a while. And that was her memory. And you think of arthritis in the neck, in the back, that arching. And was there something about that experience that had to do with these later body symptoms and her surgeries? I don't know if I'm willing to go that far, but there was something certainly to do with the dream, and there was certainly something to do with her memory. And of course, the other thing is, I said, you said something in a foreign language. And she said, "I did." I says, "Well, what language did you speak when you were 4 or 5? And she said, "We spoke Serbian." And I remembered one word of what she said. And I said the word, and I says, what does that mean? And she says, that means monkey. And of course, I didn't get, and she said, don't monkey with me. And her family, that would have been the phrase that would have been used for don't touch me in a sexual way. Don't monkey with me. Next slide, please. Oh, excuse me. This is a picture she drew of herself. And this is a softball with that has been hit too much, and its stuffings are falling out and frayed. And that is what followed this lady around. That's how she drew herself. I will say that later on, she packed up all her belongings in a van, and she took off and did a trip across the country. And I felt pretty good about that. Next slide, please. Here, I'll give you the dream, and then I'll give you a drawing that the patient made of themselves. The dream is, I am a poor, helpless little rabbit. I must hide in a thicket. I'm being circled by a predator. I don't know what it is. If I'm absolutely still, I'll be safe. If I'm absolutely still and don't move, I'll be safe. Next slide, please. And this is her drawing. This lady was about 40 when I was working with her. Any ideas? We've got a dream. We've got a picture. What kind of illness would be? What does that bring to mind?
MS.
Yes, MS. That's good. She has 3 out of 4... extremities involved. She's wheelchair bound. She was also in a very detrimental relationship, which I think, remember how I talked about staying up all night and getting stressed out? Well, I think bad relationships can make you sick too. Next picture, please. This patient is a 35-year-old black male who has had lymphoma, a form of lymph node cancer, Hodgkin's disease, for 10 years. Now, what's wrong with this picture? Somebody said it. Right. I tried to convince him that this guy isn't black, but he wouldn't buy it. And we did it. He saw his cancer as a serious adversary. They're both wounded. They're fighting to the death. This fellow had married a white woman. He went to a white church. He sung in a white choir. He totally had lost touch with any of his black roots. His recurring childhood dream was jumping off a bridge into an industrialized area. Well, I worked with him on getting in touch more with his blackness, and there was an inner character in him that he named Tyrone. And Tyrone looked black, talked black, and loved being black, and he had a lot to say to this fellow about his absence, not only from his essence, but from his lack of involvement in the black community and things of that nature. Right now, this fellow is 20 years living with lymphoma. The last time I saw him, he said that he saw himself as more a companion with his cancer than as an adversary. He still has occasional flare-ups of the disease, and he gets a little chemotherapy and goes on. Next slide, please. This is a woman with depression, she gives another picture of her dad. Remember that cool north wind? And we're going to be talking about illness and creativity tomorrow, and Rick will be talking a little bit about Sylvia Plath, but that's one of her poems to Daddy up on the wall. Next slide, please. Any ideas on what this represents? This is a panic attack, and it's really hard. There's no feet to stand on. It's sort of an incomplete drawing, but there is definitely a scared look on this figure's face. Next slide, please. This lady had infertility, recurrent bladder infections, had some traumatic a pelvic infection in the past. She came to see me and she said she wanted to look at the mind-body connections in her work. She had endometriosis and was infertile. We had two sessions together. And she got quite upset with me. She said I dug around into all the dirt in her life, and that's what I wanted to talk about. And I said, well, I said, that's what I often do. I said, those are things that need to come out. She was angry with me. After two sessions, she said, adios. She conceived with her next menstrual cycle. So I'm calling this my first mind-body baby, but but I'm careful about how I say that.
Like your first fish, right?
Yeah, right. Thank you. It was a big fish, though. Next slide, please. Now, this is a picture. You might decide, I want you to tell me whether this is serious or not serious. And I want you to decide it from the dream and the picture. Whether I was awake or not, or in a state of semi-consciousness, the clown-dressed figure appeared to me. He was laughing and jesting as to the power of my God. I don't remember being afraid, but being annoyed at the intrusion by an alien being trying to weaken my faith, especially with me laying down in a state of rest. Any ideas? And I'll repeat to you, he was jesting as to the power of my God. And I consider that a very significant jest.
It looks almost life-threatening
to me. This is life-threatening. This is a fellow that's HIV positive, and this is his dream. As yet, he has not had any opportunistic infections. Next slide, please. Go back to the previous one, Rick. This last one is a 19-year-old fellow who had twitchy legs. This kid couldn't sit still for 5 minutes, for 2 minutes. He kind of had a learning problem. He medicated himself with ample amounts of marijuana. He went into trance by, instead of amplifying his symptoms, I told him to hold his legs down so he couldn't twitch. He went into a very profound state. He began to regress to a younger and younger age. He gradually bent forward. He started seeing memories of his father who beat up his mother, beat up his brothers. He started at about age 8. He began to cry, tremendous tears. Why is everything so sad down here? He regressed all the way down to 1-year-old when he recalled being pushed away from the crib when his new little brother was brought in from the hospital. That's a common experience that kids remember. Very traumatic. Again, I didn't know, I was really asking for help here because I didn't know what I was going to do with this guy. And finally, he started to smile. A little bit of grace came into the room. And I said, what's going on? And he said, Super Chicken's here. And I said, well, great. I said, who's Super Chicken? He says, he's got the head of a chicken and the body of Superman, and he's flying with me, and he's taking me away from all this, and he's helping me. Well, I thought that was great. I said, stay with it. I says, stay with it. Let's get back to 19. And I thought the kid had just seen too many Saturday morning cartoons smoking dope. Until a couple weeks later, I was thumbing through Stephen Heller's 7 Gospels of the Dead, which is about Jung and when Jung did his dictating or channeling work or whatever we're going to call it, about Philemon, and came across this picture. Next slide, please. And does anybody know who this is? Well, you're right. But he goes by another name. And this is the Gnostic god of light and darkness, Abraxas, the head of a rooster, the body of Superman, and, well, the tail of a snake, but 2 out of 3 is good enough for me. He drives across the universe in his chariot and controls the forces of light and darkness. And my belief is that I had a little help from Abraxas. I'd like to break at this point. I do want to formally introduce Rick Nelson, our projectionist. Rick, could you stand up here? And he's going to be with questions and comments and go from there. Next slide, please, Rick. Keep going. This fellow was about 42, and he came into my medical office, and he was in shock, and not psychological shock, but physiological shock. Every time he'd be laying down and he'd sit up or stand up, his blood pressure would drop out, he'd get white, he could hardly walk. And I had no idea what was wrong with him. I thought he must be having some kind of massive hemorrhage that wasn't showing up. We got him into Ballard Hospital, and after some delay, we figured out that he had an acute effusion of fluid around his heart. In other words, he had a pericarditis with the accumulation of fluid so that his heart could not expand, and that's why he was in shock. Well, he almost died from it. He had to have a catheter put in to drain the fluid off, but he recovered. He ended up with sort of chronic chest pain. He wasn't interested in doing any mind-body work, but I did ask him to give me a picture of his pericarditis and give me a dream, and he did do that. Here's the picture. And to make a long story short, I expected him to give me in great detail his heart and the fluid around his heart and things of that nature. But really, he didn't. He drew a heart, but the detail is in these long red lines with these funny little notches in them, with one line going up to his head, representing his blood vessels. Well, there's also some other things about this picture that would you say that his prognosis is good or bad? In other words, what's going to happen to this fellow? It's pretty catastrophic. This picture doesn't look good. There's no feet to stand on. He's still wearing his medic alert bracelet. The watch has no hands on it, and the pupils are pretty wide and dilated, and the hair looks suspiciously like vegetation is taking over. He gave me a dream, and the dream was that he was in Vietnam, and there was fighting, and then one of the Viet Cong got put in the hospital on a respirator, and he disconnected the respirator and was court-martialed for it. And he said, the paradox is, I could have killed him outside in the firefight, but inside, I couldn't disconnect him. Well, okay, here it comes. 2 years later, he has a big stroke. And now he's 44. He knocks out half of his body. And of course, one of his carotid arteries was plugged up. And he only has drawn in one carotid artery. And that's quite interesting as to why he didn't draw into what the psyche knew. He had, after that, a series of small strokes. He ended up in the hospital. He ended up on a respirator. We didn't know what was wrong with him. Finally, we did an arteriogram, which is putting some dye in his neck. The arteriogram showed that he didn't just have hardening of the arteries and plaques, but he had vasculitis, which is inflammation of the blood vessels in his vascular system. And the characteristic of this is beating of the blood vessels on the arteriogram. In other words, there are little knots and beads on the arteriogram. Now, of course, I remembered then that he gave me a drawing, and I pulled it out, and of course, there it was. Unfortunately, he went on to die. And the autopsy showed that he did indeed have this vasculitis. It was a hard case for me because I knew this fellow for 10 years. But it's a profound case in that I believe that with his dream and with this drawing that Psyche knew what was going on. And it's somewhat better than a CAT scan or a PET scan, an arteriogram. It's right on the problem. Next slide, please. This is a woman who, in her early 20s, who came to see me with forearm pain and hand pain, carpal tunnel syndrome. She wasn't getting any better. People here have it. It's an impingement of the median nerve at the wrist. She's a computer operator. It hurts her. She was having trouble working. She had a strange dream when she was a little kid, of a recurrent dream of her fingers falling off, of her hands being mutilated, of having her arms cut off at the wrist. Well, I wanted to work with this lady because I thought something was up. She was referred to me by a neurologist. I said, well, let me touch your arms where they're sore here, and we'll see if we've got some memories. And she says, no, you may not touch my arms. Well, I got the hint, and I said, well, and I backed off about 3 feet. I says, would you touch your arms for me and just kind of see if you have any memories here? And of course she did. And her memories was of being a 10-year-old girl and having her father commit suicide in the garage by carbon monoxide poisoning. If that wasn't bad enough, the whole family had to pick up and move to a new area. They were befriended by an older grandfather-type man who did some chores for her mother. And he used to sit this little girl on her lap, on his lap, and he gave her some nurturing. And then one day, he took her forearms and turned her around and put both of her hands on his erect penis. Well, that was pretty traumatic. We don't know how many times that happened. But that's what she remembered as she went back through this. And you remember that her dream about mutilated hands long preceded that event. But here's another example of, we're going to go relationships or systems theory. Did one thing cause the other? No, but they're certainly related. And the way out of this, I think, is by working on these memories and processing them. And she's improving slowly. There were no fast answers here for her. Next slide. Actually, let's go back one. The last series of slides, and this is the last case, represent 3 years of work that I did with a Vietnam vet with post-traumatic stress. Dave was born to an abusive alcoholic father. His mother was more than glad to let him take the brunt of his father's anger. At age 5, Dave was forced to put on boxing gloves and he'd have to go downstairs and box with his dad down the basement. And it just depended on what kind of a day Dave had as to how bad it was and how much he got beat up. This continued until Dave was 15. He became a very good boxer, and he cold cocked his dad with one punch, and that ended the boxing downstairs. But his dad went on and continued to be an abusive parent, and later on abused his younger sister. His dad was a Marine in World War II who had never seen combat, and it had probably been good if he had some real combat. He used to trace the Marine Corps bulldog on Dave's arm when he was a kid. So Dave came to be about 19 or 20. It was 1968. He was in school. And one day he just couldn't take it anymore, and he went and joined the Marine Corps. He was sent to Vietnam. Well, every bad thing that you've heard about, every rotten thing about Vietnam, every reason why that war is still a sore point in our psyches and in our men and women's psyche happened to Dave. And I won't go into the details, but it included torture of prisoners. It included wounding of, of his friends and many, many personal losses. Dave returned to the United States, got into music, did some very successful songwriting. Like a lot of vets, he went back to school. But he went to the wrong school, I guess, because on May 4th, 1970, he witnessed another great tragedy at the school he registered to. Does anyone know what happened that day? That's right. And he was on a hillside. And his reaction to that was that there was no difference. What the hell was going on here? He dropped out of school. He got into drugs, prescription drugs, because of his chronic psychosomatic complaint. He got into a marriage that some people would call codependent, had a child. I began to see him then for his psychosomatic complaint, and I'll show you some pictures that he drew of that. Next slide, please. This is a slide when he's feeling good. He also became a fundamentalist Christian, which may have helped Dave, but I didn't think it helped me much in working with him, but that may be my stuff. So here's a cross here, and here's a pretty normal-looking guy with his head on a cloud. Next slide. And here's Dave when he's getting his symptom. You'll notice a marked change in facial features and his affect. We've got a symbol for Christ, but now it's down in the throat. And the last slide is when his psychosomatic symptom is going full bore. Next slide, please. And this is when he's got one. Any ideas on what he's got? That's right, migraines. And of course, the first slide is when he's feeling good. The second slide is when he's having his aura. And the third slide is when he's got one. Well, this is a real interesting picture. For the sake of time, I'll tell you some comments that I've got. If anybody's got any other ones, this is Christ at Gethsemane, Christ with the crown of thorns, a werewolf, you know, the change from Dr. Jekyll to Mr. Hyde or vice, whatever it was. We did a lot of work together. We tried to reduce his drugs. Things were not totally successful. I finally got him to go to the VA because I feel the only way out for a vet with this kind of post-traumatic stress from Vietnam is another group of vets that can carry him through. My Vietnam experience was being a doctor on an ammunition ship, which I thought was bad enough. Next picture, please. This is a picture of what's called family portraits. This is how Dave drew his family. Not a lot of emotion there. Dave's number three. He has a double symbol for his head. In fact, three symbols, I guess. I guess for the three stages of his headaches. Next slide. This is a drawing that his little six-year-old boy did of the family. And it's disturbing in some ways. And actually, the mother is here. And the feminine was somewhat devalued in this family. As you can, in a sense, Dave had a hard time because of his mother's absence, letting his father abuse him. But all the people have these teeth, and all the pets look like they're being choked. And things got somewhat better. I think that's the last slide. Will you check, Rick? I mentioned that Dave became a very famous songwriter, although he never got any recognition from it because his self-esteem was so bad he sold off all his songs without getting the credit for it. But he wrote the words to a very famous song that was done by Bruce Springsteen. And the song is Born in the USA, and we've all heard it. And usually what you remember are the words Born in the USA, because that's all you can really remember. But I assure you that Springsteen did not go to Vietnam, and that he didn't write this song. And I think you'll see that Dave had to write this song because of the words, and it's a little hard for me to read, but I'm going to go ahead and read it to you anyway. I have a lot of empathy with the Vietnam veterans. And I'll close with this, and then we'll have some questions. But these are the words to the song. Born down in a dead man's town, the first kick I took was when I hit the ground. You end up like a dog that's been beat too much till you spend half your life just covering up. Born in the USA. Got in a little hometown jam, so they put a rifle in my hands, sent me off to a foreign land to go and kill the yellow man. Born in the USA. Coming back home to the refinery, hiring man says, "Son, if it was up to me." Went down to see my VA man, he said, "Son, don't you just understand? Now born in the USA." I had a brother at Khe Sanh fighting off the Viet Cong. He's still there. They're still there. He's all gone. He had a woman he loved in Saigon. I got a picture of him in her arms. Born in the USA. Down in the shadow of the penitentiary, out by the gas fires of the refinery, I'm 10 years, now 20 years, burning down the road, got nowhere to run, ain't got nowhere to go. I was born in the USA. Thank you.
I just wanted to share some of my feelings that came up for me when I was looking at the pictures of some of your patients, starting with the irritable bowel syndrome. I thought it was very interesting that this woman used the colors red and black, which traditionally are signs of rage and anger and death and destruction, and that in comparison to the other colors that were used in the picture, those really stood out to focus on that. And I just wondered, you mentioned that she had suffered from abuse from her father and stuff, and I just wondered if that had ever been resolved or if she was better or not, because we see a lot of irritable bowel syndrome patients and they don't really have a good prognosis.
She got a little better. I do agree with your colors. Every time I show these slides, somebody points out something to me that I've missed. In this particular case, we ran into insurance problems, and I think we had about 6 sessions together. And I don't really know how she's doing. I know that we got in, if you can say that, or that she got in, mm-hmm. and that she had insight, and that we changed the way she looked at her illness, and that's really, I regard that as a primary step in healing.
A patient of ours at the clinic that we saw, whose mother had died of cancer, developed irritable bowel syndrome when her mother died, and she was deathly afraid also of getting cancer, and had been told by her medical doctor, she was on all kinds of drugs, sulfasalazine and everything for her bowel, and her doctor said that 9 out of 10 patients with your condition end up getting cancer anyway. And so she came to us. I'm at the naturopathic clinic, the natural health clinic. And she came to us wanting confirmation from some patient with the same condition who hadn't gotten cancer within 10 years. You know, she was so mm-hmm. completely brain, you know, affected by this doctor who told her that she was just living in constant terror. Anyway, the other comment I had was on Dave and his third picture, which to me looked absolutely reptilian. The way that his mouth came up like that on the side, it looked like you had accessed his reptilian brain in that one.
So, wow.
At least that was my impression.
Well, it's down in there somewhere. Thank you. Go ahead, please.
Oh. A little pressure on you to wait for the microphone here. I was struck by the 6-year-old's drawing of the dog mm-hmm. being somewhat related to reptilian, and Dad's mention of dog in the song, mm-hmm. that Dad really in some respects maybe shows up in the drawing of the child as the dog. If you'll notice, mm-hmm. the hair flows off of the dog very much like Dad's mm-hmm. third picture. Mm-hmm. It's almost identical in its, you know, in its mm-hmm. potency.
Can we look at that again, Rick? Just run it backwards. Now
you look at that, and now look at the dog in the picture.
Okay. Well, I'd say they got the same expression. the hair is, he had that sticking up hair there.
Yeah.
Well.
But I don't know that it's actually so. It's just it's an interesting parallel that the dog is so lit up, so.
Yeah, the dog's hair is standing on end, you might say. Mm-hmm.
That's not actually what I wanted to ask you. I wanted to know if you know Dr. Lewis Meehl's work in Tucson.
I've talked to him once on the phone, and I've been trying to get his book for a long time. I've never been able to get a hold of it.
I'll loan you my copy.
Well, thank you.
You must know each other because there's kindred spirits between you.
We talked once.
Did you?
Okay. In the back, please.
I was relating some of my own work with what you said, and I'm glad to have, your theoretical framework to grasp, because I was really looking for something like this, a void. But in my own experience, I had run across my memories. They weren't cognitive memories, and they seemed to originate in my chest area. And so the question came up, does the body potentially have other places to store memories? They don't all have to be in your head.
I think that's a debatable point, and it depends on who you're talking to. Traumatic memories are not processed in the same way because the cerebral cortex gets shut out of the picture. So it certainly seems to the person that if you had an old shoulder injury, that memory was right out of my shoulder. Now, a neurologist would debate you, and he or she would say, that's impossible. You have to have the brain to have a memory, and that's a limbic memory. I'm willing to say that there are plenty of memories that are probably stored in the body, and that's just an important thing to know and not argue about the theory. Please.
You also, in the case of Dave, I guess you mentioned the self-medicating with drugs and alcohol. My question is, how does one effectively work with people who engage in this kind of behavior?
Well, I had to learn the hard way on this one, and I think I've had to go back to a 12-step agreement that I cannot work with people when they're actively drinking or they're actively using drugs, particularly if they want to work with me and they want me to prescribe them drugs. That screws up the whole thing. And I tried to do it with Dave, and I won't say that my work was invalid and we did get somewhere, but it was just so much harder. If I could have got him into a rehab program and dried him out, I think we may have gotten further. But I think people have to stop their chemical addiction, and then they can do some work. And I'd go along with the 12 steps on that.
Well, let me follow up on this. Often you get in a cycle, and you say, they first have to do this, but they may not be able to first do this because the other has other problems.
Yeah.
What does one do?
You do the...
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.